We're on week three of our series on everyday discipleship. What does it mean to follow Jesus every day? And to start our time together, I want to talk about the idea or the purpose of a bridge. Probably not new to any of us. Some of you may take a bridge on a regular basis, especially if you perhaps work in New Jersey or you head to the shore. We're familiar with the bridges connecting Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So the concept of a bridge is pretty basic, right? A bridge is meant to connect two places. It's to help you to get from one place to another place, usually over water or a ravine or something that's hard to get across any other way. Bridges are important in our lives. They allow us to get to places that we want to get to. Again, for many of us, if you head to the Jersey Shore, you got to take a bridge at some point and to get where you want to go. Perhaps one of my favorite bridges is the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. How many of you have taken that one? Yeah, probably a lot of you have, right? A little over 17 miles above the water. Then you go below the water. You do that a couple of times, and you end up on the other side of the Chesapeake Bay there in Virginia. And one of the reasons this is my favorite bridge is it's cool to do that and have the kids try to hold their breath as you go under and then come out the other side, right? And you, of course, just keep breathing and tell them, yeah, I'm doing it, but see if they can make it. But really, one of the reasons it's one of my favorite bridges is because it takes me, it's one of the ways that we go to one of my favorite places, which is the Outer Banks in North Carolina. And as a family, we have enjoyed going there for many years with good friends and other family members. And it's always a time of, when we're going across that bridge, it's always a good thing. Like, we're getting closer. We're, that maybe the hard part of the drive is behind us. Now we're within an hour or two of our destination, and it starts to get really, really exciting. Bridges take us where we want to go. And I want to use that as an example for where we're going this morning, because as followers of Jesus, we have an opportunity that God gives us on a regular basis to help build bridges, to help people build bridges to Jesus, that they might get where God ultimately wants them to go, a relationship with himself. And so my theme this morning, my statement is this: everyday discipleship means actively building bridges for people to come to Jesus every day. As followers of Jesus, it should be on our hearts and minds, what am I doing every day to help build a bridge? I am not able to save anyone. God saves people. God rescues people. God works in people's hearts. But he invites me to be a part of the process by which he builds a bridge to enter into that person's life, to help them understand who he is. And we get to be a part of that as followers of Jesus. What does it mean to be actively involved in building bridges for people to come to Jesus, to make it easier for them to walk across and to experience his love? The Apostle Paul gives us a great example of what this looks like. And if you have your Bibles, I want to encourage you to open to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, it's page 1097 in the Pew Bible. If you'd like to follow along there, we'd encourage you to do that. We're going to pick it up in verse 16, but let me set the stage a little bit before we get into the story that we're going to look at this morning. It's about 50 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. The church has been growing and is continuing to grow. Paul is making journeys, traveling around the Roman world, starting churches, sharing the good news of Jesus. And on his second missionary journey, as he goes to these different cities to share, usually it's a common pattern. He would go to the Jewish synagogue in the city, and he would start there with people who had a common foundation, and he would build that bridge to help them understand that the one they've been waiting for has come, and his name is Jesus. And to help them understand that he is indeed the true Messiah. And so there's a lot of common ground that he could use with the Old Testament to help them come to that conclusion. But he wouldn't limit it to just being in the synagogue. Often he would go to the public places in the city and he would just interact with people. And he would just begin to share. And sometimes it would be in larger context, sometimes in smaller. But he would share the good news about Jesus. And often we would see that he would get mixed reactions. Some would be really intrigued by what he would say. Some would come to faith in Jesus. And yes, this is what we've been waiting for. And now I understand. And they come to faith. Others weren't so excited about his message. And as he's traveling in the second journey, he goes to the city of Thessalonica. And there's a riot that actually begins to happen because of his sharing about Jesus. And they have to take him out of the city and usher him away. And he goes to Berea, which is just a little ways away. He does the same thing. And the people in Thessalonica who didn't like him are so upset, they go to Berea and raise trouble there. And so at night, he's got to get ushered out of the city. And a couple of his friends take him, and they begin this long travel to the city of Athens. And they probably went by boat, and they sailed in there. And as they get to Athens, this new place for Paul to begin to share the good news, his friends depart to go back and tell Timothy and Silas where Paul is and that they can come later and join him. So at least as far as we know at this point, he could well be alone in the city of Athens. Paul almost always traveled with Christian brothers, with friends, to kind of help him in his journey, and it was just a great example of community. But he seemed to find him on his own as he enters into the city of Athens. This city was an amazing city in the time that Paul lived. He probably would have arrived through one of the ports and then made the 3-mile walk to the city. And as he approached, he would have seen, of course, one of the things that you can still see today. The amphitheater was there, seated 60,000 people. I mean, I was watching the Penn State game last night and the whiteout, and they were saying there were over 100,000 people in that stadium. I mean, just in that day, 2,000 years ago, imagine 60,000 people sitting in an amphitheater with no microphones, nothing like that, and just somebody speaking or a play happening or whatever was happening in there that they were watching. It's pretty amazing to think about. You also would have seen the Parthenon, one of the ancient wonders of the world. And in the Parthenon, there was a massive statue of the goddess Diana, as the Romans called her, or Athena, as the Greeks called her. And it was also the home of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, all of these famous philosophers that many of us studied in school or had to read about, or read about their thinking and what they taught. Many of them either were born here or called this their home, and these philosophical schools were built up in the city of Athens. It was a common thing for people just to sit and debate about different ideas. And one of the first things you would notice as you headed into Athens that Paul did notice were statues. Not only in the Parthenon was a statue of Diana or Athena, but there were statues throughout the city. One of the historians of the day, Pliny, wrote that in the time of Nero, Athens had well over 25,000 public statues. Think about that. That's a lot. And another 30,000 in the Parthenon alone. So more than in the city, were more than just in the Parthenon, and this place obviously was huge. Another person wrote that it was easier to find a god than a man in Athens. That tells you a little bit about the environment that Paul walked into. And I think it's important for us to understand this, because right away we're going to see in verse 16 of Acts 17 that Paul noticed it too. And as we build bridges, we're going to look at some things that we can learn about what Paul did to help us to build bridges into people's lives. Verse 16 says, while Paul was waiting for them, meaning Silas and Timothy, in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Now, just to pause there, for him to come to that understanding means that he must have walked through the city. He must have at least, to some degree, exposed himself of walking down streets and seeing what he saw, maybe going to some of these public places. He interacted, it doesn't say for sure, but I would guess that he interacted with people and maybe heard some of their stories and began to question them about what he was seeing and what was going on. He observed the people, the customs, the idols, initiating conversations, asking questions, listening to responses, and what he experienced just set his soul at unease. He didn't feel right about what he was experiencing, because he knew that he had an answer that they were looking for. And he began already to be thinking, how can I build a bridge for people here in Athens to understand who God really is? He encountered people with different views on a lot of different things, just like we do today. As he interacted, I'm sure, you know, different idols were for different purposes. And if you think about our culture today, if you walked around our town or our city, you probably wouldn't see stone or gold or precious metal statues. In other countries, you still would see things like that. Probably not here in the United States so much. But if you really paid attention and you walked around in our culture and you interacted with people, you would begin to see that there are idols in our lives. Every culture has idols. Some are just more apparent than others. And when we look around and we see in our culture, what are those idols? What are those things that people are looking to bring them fulfillment? We might even say, what are they worshiping? And what I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean they're physically bowing down to them, but the way they invest their time, the way they invest their resources, the way they invest their finances, it's obvious that whatever this is holds supreme importance in their lives. And I think we'd see a lot of them today. Certainly we would see the idol of money or possessions, where that has become supremely important in some people's lives in our culture. We see the idol of sex or sensual pleasure. Watch TV, view movies, whatever. You see it, it's right there. It's something that you can almost see people bowing down to. Their desire for it is so great. They almost do whatever just to experience that pleasure. The idol of leisure or comfort. Whatever it is that just makes my life easier, that I don't have to do as much, that I can sit in my recliner a little bit longer during the day, whatever it is. You know, we can see that is something that we seek to attain. Even the idea of retirement is often the idea of so I can do nothing or I can just go and do a couple of things that I really enjoy. Again, I've tried to be clear before. I'm not against the idea of retirement, but I think the American idea of retirement doesn't often reflect God's purposes for us. Retirement's a great thing. Use it to further the mission of God, whatever that looks like in your life. The idol of popularity or acceptance. We see this through social media. How many likes someone gets, the response to my story or whatever I've just posted on Instagram or Snapchat, the idea that I just crave this acceptance and this acknowledgement, and that can become an idol in our lives, even causing us to do things that are hurtful to ourselves or others just to gain that popularity. The idol of relationships, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a spouse, even children can become idols in our lives. Even grandchildren can become idols in our lives, where our lives begin to focus completely, or they become the center of our lives, and everything else comes after that. We often hold that up as something that is of grand value to us. It can become an idol. Now notice, these things that I've said, none of them are necessarily wrong in and of themselves. Money and possessions, God ordained sex, it's not wrong. Acceptance, God's designed us to want to be accepted. It's where we look for it that matters. So you can go through this list. It's not that these things in and of themselves, but when we put them in a place that they shouldn't be, when we put them as the number one priority, as we make it everything else comes after these things, that's where we get ourselves into trouble. These are the idols that we face. So how do we respond? Well, how did Paul respond? For Paul, what he saw and perhaps heard as he interacted with people led to what he did. And I think this is important because as we interact with people in our culture who may be following after other things, maybe God isn't first place in their life. And by the way, this isn't just people who don't know Jesus. We as followers of Jesus struggle with these same things. This is not an us and them. We're all in this together. We just understand at least that God needs to have first place in our lives. We still struggle at times for that to happen. But as we interact with people who have different views on relationships and sexual ethics, different views on abortion, we witness people ignoring or even abusing those who are less powerful or in need of help. And I'm just mentioning a couple of the hot issues of the day. As we interact and rub shoulders, as we listen to where they're coming from, as we see the decisions that they make, we have a choice of how we respond, just like Paul had a choice of how he responded. And I want to look at two things he didn't do before I look at one thing that he did. What he didn't do is he didn't just throw up his hands and walk out of the city saying, well, this is hopeless, let's just go on to the next place. And yet sometimes we as followers of Jesus, we can be in environments where we're like, there's just no way. And we kind of throw up our hands like, there's no hope for this. And we just leave and we walk out and we go on. And we forget that we actually represent the God of hope. That's who we represent. So hopeless is where God shows up best. Because that's what he is. He brings hope into hopeless situations. And so maybe in those conversations or those interactions that you have with people where you're like, man, I don't see this person ever becoming a follower of Jesus. You know, I just think I need to move on. And I understand maybe there are some times where that might be appropriate where they just continually reject you and what you have to say. But sometimes we give up a little too quickly. We don't really want to get involved in the messiness and we walk away. Paul didn't do that. He also didn't shake his fist in anger saying, you're hopeless. He didn't walk out kind of throwing up his hand saying, this is hopeless. But he also didn't shake his fist at them saying, you're hopeless. And you can see the finger and the judgment and the tone of voice. And unfortunately, sometimes in our culture, followers of Jesus can be known for this. That when we interact with people who disagree perhaps with what we believe to be a godly view on things or a biblical view on things, that we switch into judgmental mode and we just begin to condemn and tell them that they're wrong and repeat that, thinking that somehow they'll eventually hear us and they'll make the change. And all it generally does is drive the wedge further between us and them. And Paul didn't do that either. We don't see evidence of him just angrily denouncing what was going on in the city. I understand there may be times for that. I understand that Jesus at times would do it. First of all, he's Jesus. And secondly, there's a lot of other circumstances going on there. I think we switch into that mode sometimes as the church in America far too quickly. I'm thankful that I don't believe that spirit is alive and well here at Davisville, but I think we need to be aware of it, that often people expect that of us. So what did he do? Well, he thoughtfully engaged them, intent on sharing with them the good news of Jesus because they needed hope. They were hopeless. That's why he was there. God had sent him there to bring them hope, and that's how we need to view it as well. So verse 17 says, what did he do? So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks. He started with those who he had that common foundation with, like he would in any other city that he went to. He found the synagogue. He found the Jewish people who believed the Old Testament, believed that a Messiah was coming, God-fearing Greeks. So he's talking to people who are like him, people who are not like him. He's open to sharing this with anybody. But he didn't just do it in the synagogue. He didn't just do it in what we might say are the church or our religious place of gathering. He also did it in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. Paul was willing to walk out and engage people right in the middle of their culture. He was willing to go out in the agora, the marketplace in Athens, and to spend time just interacting with people, asking questions, seeing what they thought, and being able to share his convictions. He moved toward people, not with anger, but with compassion and conviction, because he was convinced he knew the answer. Not because he was smarter than everybody else. He was in a town where people were known for their intelligence and their ability to debate. Philosophy was huge in the city of Athens. He wasn't coming in as the one who was smarter than everyone else. He was coming in as the one who God had changed his life on a road to Damascus, and he needed to tell other people about this God who could change their lives too. He did know the answer because Jesus had revealed it to him, and the answer is Jesus. So verse 18 says, a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. This is common practice. This is what the city was known for. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? You can see they were very encouraging in their encouragement of him to keep talking. I hope none of you think that on a Sunday morning. Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. As I was thinking about this, and I researched this a little bit more. I'm like, why would talking about Jesus and the resurrection be advocating foreign gods? And it's interesting that the word for resurrection in Greek is very similar to the feminine name Anastasis. So they were probably thinking that Paul was talking about Jesus and Anastasis. And they were thinking he was bringing this idea of a male and a female god figure, which was very common in that day. So they're actually thinking he was advocating some kind of male god and female god and that whole idea, which they would have been familiar with. Instead of, no, he's talking about Jesus and the resurrection, that this Jesus is now alive. And he needed to clarify. Sometimes when we're interacting with people and we say something, it may be new to them and they don't understand what it is that we're saying. And we need to back up and we need to unpack what it is and we need to say it in a way that they might be able to better understand. Again, not because they're not as intelligent as we are, because they have not been exposed to some of the things we may be sharing with them before. Just like when we first heard it, we probably didn't understand it all and we needed somebody to clearly explain it to us. You know, whenever you stand for something, whenever you take a stand for something, doesn't even matter what it is, you will encounter opposition. If you plant your flag in the ground on an issue, something, anything, there will be people who will agree and there'll be people who disagree, right? You will encounter opposition and you will likely be misunderstood. So just prepare yourself. If you want to help build bridges to Jesus, you will probably be viewed negatively at some point, and you will likely be misunderstood. Just count yourself in good company, because Jesus was not liked by everybody and was often misunderstood. So if it could happen to him, don't beat yourself up about it. You may be doing it right or clearly or whatever word we might want to use. It's just when we do that, there's going to be those differing responses. Now, who are the groups of people that he was dealing with here? The Stoics were the ones who believed reason is king. You know, even today we have the idea, we use this word Stoic. A very Stoic individual. Usually means reserved. You know, they do things properly. Those were the Stoics of that day as well. Reason was king. They were more moderate. They were restrained in their behavior and emotions. Ethically, they would be kind of similar to the Jewish people in having morals and seeking to follow many of those morals. Not exactly, but somewhat close to that. Now, you contrast that with the Epicureans. Their mantra is that pleasure is king. So you've got the Stoics, reason is king. The Epicureans were pleasure is king. They're the ones, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. It's all going to be over, so just have the best time you possibly can this time around. And it's interesting, as we interact with people, we can see people falling into these different groupings. They may not use these terms and probably wouldn't. But you interact with people, you get to know that people are different in how they approach life and how they make decisions. And so that means that when we seek to build bridges, it's not just one bridge works for everybody. Now, hear me, the end destination is the same. We want everybody to get to Jesus and for Jesus to get to them. That doesn't change. We're not building bridges to different places, but the bridge that we build may look different depending on the person that we're interacting with and how we go about that interaction. By the way, this idea of seeking foreign gods or advocating foreign gods I talked about, Socrates had been accused of advocating foreign gods a few centuries earlier, and they executed him. So for Paul, if he knew his history, if they start to accuse him of that, he knows that generally doesn't go well. So again, there's sometimes the difficulty, the opposition that we face, but also sometimes the misunderstanding. So facing condescension and confusion, he's not seems to be being received real positively, at least at this point. He might be actually saying, well, this isn't going too well. So what does he do? Verse 19. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean. And then in parentheses, Luke helps us who are readers understand that all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about listening to the latest ideas. Kind of a little commentary by Luke there for us, right? So this was common practice. Now this group that they took them to was a group of about 100 people. They were kind of like the city council of Athens and the judicial system. So put that together and these 100 people represented the leadership of the city of Athens. And now Paul is taken and put before them and said, we'd like to hear what you have to say. And so he has this opportunity to speak to the movers and the shakers of the city, you might say. And all of a sudden, I can imagine what Paul must be feeling. They want to know more, which leads to an opportunity. It's intimidating, yet it's amazing. And sometimes God will open a door when you are willing to begin building a bridge. Sometimes God will take it to a place you might not have expected and give you even greater opportunity to share than you may have thought you were going to have. And if God's the one moving and doing that, then really, there's really no other option but take it. Step into it. You may feel inadequate. We talked about Moses last week. You may feel unqualified. But if God gives you that platform, then he is going to give you the words to speak. Step into it. And that's what Paul does. So in verse 22, Paul takes the opportunity. And let's see what he does. He stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, people of Athens, he addresses his audience. I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I am going to proclaim to you. Now, in my opinion, this is somewhat of a brilliant approach. He starts by complimenting them, not condemning them. He says, I see that you are very religious. He gives it now. Notice he said religious, and that can be very broad, but they would have seen that as a positive thing. Yeah, we are. Look at, 30,000, 25,000 idols, statues. We're religious, all right. Yeah, and he notices that. And he says, for as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I love this. He doesn't just go off the hip and assume he knows his audience. He has done his research. He walked around. He read the inscriptions. He knows. He's gotten to know, and I know it's probably fairly brief. We don't know how long after he got to Athens this conversation is taking place, but at least there was some time for him to get to know the culture, get to know the belief system, begin to understand somewhat of his audience. And so he was able to speak to them and say, I've looked, I've walked, I've been among you. I've looked carefully. I'm not just going to make overriding statements or overbrushed statements that kind of lump you all into one. I've seen it, so I want to address what I've seen. And I even found an altar, and he zeroes in to this one that he wants to use as building this bridge to an unknown God. Now, there is a theory that the reason they had this is because the city went through a time of severe plague, and as they called out to their gods, the plague was not abating. And so they figured there's got to be a God out there that we don't know about that's the one to offer to or worship to. So they literally built an altar to an unknown God, hoping that whatever one they didn't know could help them. Now, if that story is correct, think about the bridge that is. In your history, you've realized that your gods haven't helped you. And so you acknowledge that there might be some other God out there that could help you. I want to tell you about that God. That's why I'm here, because I know his name, and I can share that with you. Now, notice when he says, so you are ignorant, we view that as a very negative word. When you call somebody ignorant, it's not viewed positively. But think about what the word ignorant means. It just means you don't know. He's not putting them down by using this word. He's basically saying, so what you don't know, I'm here to tell you, because it's been revealed to me. I have the privilege of knowing this information. This is what I'm going to proclaim to you. He has their attention. All right, tell us. We want to hear. He started with where they were. He listened and observed well enough to know how to connect with them. And I think sometimes as followers of Jesus, we skip this important step. And in your journals for the life group experience, this week is all about listening. It's so important to develop our listening skills, to be able to truly hear people and hear where they're coming from. Because unfortunately, sometimes, especially if we feel the responsibility, and rightly so, that I need to share the good news with the people around me, many times we learn a way of doing that, which is a good tool to have in our tool belts. But then every interaction we have, we treat it exactly the same. Because we don't listen to the individual and realize, oh, wow, that my point, my bridge building needs to look like this for this individual. And it might look a little different for this individual that I'm talking to, because they're coming at life from a completely different standpoint. A completely different way. We need to know our audience. We need to listen to people before we're so quick to tell them what we know. And this will look different for everyone. So what did it look like for Paul? Verse 24, the God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. You know, you've built these temples. You have this statue of Diana, Athena, in your Parthenon, in your temple. I just want you to know the God I'm talking about, he made everything. And he doesn't live in temples. So right there, there's a differentiation that he's making. This God is different. Verse 25, he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. In other words, these idols needed them to carve the idol, to take care of the idol, to offer food to the idol. All of these things this idol required. It couldn't do anything for itself. And again, Paul's saying, I want to differentiate. This is something different. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. In one sense, you might say, you gave your idols life. You carved them. You made these statues. You were the one who did all that. I want to tell you about a God. He's the one who gives everybody else life. He breathes life into all of us. From one man, he made all the nations. He talks about a common ancestor, that they should inhabit the whole earth. In other words, God has a plan. And he marked out their, meaning their nations, appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. Wow. So what you're saying, Paul, is that, you know, when Greece had its day, you're saying this God appointed that, and now Rome has its day, and you're saying God appointed that? You're saying these major movements and who we're under and who's in power, you're saying this God is big enough to orchestrate all that? Yes, I am. God did this, why? So that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. God is doing all that he's doing to prompt us to reach out to him. Just like you're reaching out to this unknown God, he wants you to know him and reach out and find him, that he is this one true being. And then in verse 28, he does something interesting, another bridge to their culture. He quotes two poets of their day that they would have been familiar with. He starts in verse 28, "For in him we live and move and have our being." It's from the Cretan philosopher Epimenides. And he uses that, again, as part of his bridge building, this God that is close, who's actually breathing life into us. It's a similar idea to something you already have in place. And then he goes on, as some of your own poets have said, and he quotes another one, the philosopher Aratus, "We are his offspring." And this is taken from a poem of that day about Zeus, the supreme god in the Greek viewpoint, their belief system. And the poem goes like this: Zeus fills the streets, the marts. Zeus fills the seas, the shrines or the shores, and the rivers. Everywhere our need is Zeus, and we also are his offspring. Interesting. This poem is Zeus is everywhere. He's all that we need, and we all need him. And we are related to him in some way. And Paul takes that and builds a bridge. You're already talking about being related to a supreme God. I want to build on that idea. I want to help you understand who that is. And what he's doing here would be like quoting the Old Testament to a Jewish individual and helping them understand that Jesus is indeed the Messiah. It would be like quoting from the Quran to someone who is a Muslim and helping them understand Allah and God and how those two things are similar and yet how they're different. It means building that bridge to be able to talk to someone on their terms to help them come to understand what it is that you're sharing. And then he goes on, verse 29, "Therefore, since we are God's offspring," he brings it now back to God, "we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone." Again, he's different, an image made by human design and skill. "In the past, God overlooked." Now he's made the differentiation. The gods that you worship and this one true God, I've told you how they're similar and I've told you how they're different. And now here he's coming, he's moving now to the ask. This is what he's going to ask of them. He says, "In the past, God overlooked such ignorance. But now, he commands all people everywhere to repent." God is calling people everywhere to change their minds, to come to understand who he really is, and to accept him for who he is. Why is that important? Verse 31, "For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. Because there is coming a day of accountability when everyone will be held account." And that's something that's embedded in the scriptures, in our belief system as followers of Jesus, that there is a day of accountability coming. Now, as followers of Jesus, we know the great news that Jesus has paid the price that should come to us. The judgment that should come to us has been already dealt with because of what Jesus did on the cross and through his resurrection. And we get to share that great news with people, but they have to understand that there is a day of accountability coming. And the one who's going to do it is the man he's appointed. Well, now I want to know, who are you talking about? Who's going to be the one who's going to be the decider? Who's going to be the one who's going to hold us accountable? And he has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. You want to know how this God authenticated the one who's going to hold us all accountable? He raised him from the dead. That's what he did. And when he says that, he gets a little bit of a reaction. Right? What he's saying, change your mind from a wrong view of God to a right one. Because Jesus is coming and will hold us accountable. How do we know it's Jesus? Because this God raised him from the dead. All that came before was Paul's building the bridge to get to the good news about Jesus. And I would also say this, we can be really good bridge builders, but unless we get to Jesus, we're building the bridge in vain. Because there are all kinds of religious systems that are building bridges, but they're not building bridges to Jesus. And Paul was always clear that if you want to know the one who can change your life, who can forgive you, that you don't have to be afraid of judgment, it's Jesus. We've got to get to Jesus. And in doing, I think there's sometimes the power of a question. When we're talking with someone and they share something about their beliefs and these questions, I was looking over some of the training that some of our young adults are going through from the porch, the ministry that they participate in on Tuesday nights. They have some great training tools, and some of them are questions just to ask people to find out more. They call them clarifying questions. These are not new, but I think they're great things for us to be reminded of. When you're interacting with someone and you get to the point of seeing what they believe or they're sharing about their beliefs, sometimes it's great to just say, what do you mean by that? When they say that something about their faith system or where they are spiritually, what do you mean by that? Could you tell me a little bit more? For a great example, you may say, well, you know, I'm Christian, right? And you're interacting with somebody. Maybe you got to the point of saying, hey, do you go to a church or what's your spiritual background like? Well, I'm Christian. Okay, that's great. What do you mean by that? Because if you prompt in our society and culture today, you could get 5 different answers or more to the question of what Christian really is. So be willing to go a little deeper. What do you mean by that? And another great question, how did you come to that conclusion? Maybe they share with you that they've come to this conclusion, you know, that this is all there is. Just eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die. There's no afterlife. Okay. I don't challenge that initially. How did you get there? How did you come to that conclusion? What has led you to that conclusion? And as they explain how they got where they are, you have opportunity then to perhaps pose another viewpoint or another way of looking at it. For some, they've had a very thoughtful process to get to their conclusion. Others, not so much. They just have it because someone else has it that they respect, or you know, they have it because they haven't really thought about it, but that must be what it is to them. But it allows you a glimpse into their thought process. The key is to listen. We need to listen. And then lastly, as we wrap up, when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them, here's the responses, some of them sneered, but others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. At that, Paul left the council. He was done. He didn't stay. He didn't have more to say. He said it. He's done. Some of the people became followers of Paul and believed. And I think the idea is followers of Paul, meaning, and then followers of Jesus. Among them was Dionysus, and he names a couple people, a woman named Damaris, a number of others. So there's a people who believe. And I think we see 3 responses that we can expect if we seek to build a bridge to Jesus. Some people will reject. They'll shut you down. They don't want to hear about it. They're pretty set in what they've, you know, concluded, and they're not really open to dialogue. That's their choice. There are others who will be intrigued. They're not convinced, but they want to know more. What a great opportunity to be prepared to share more about why you believe what you believe. And there will be those who God will lead them to belief. And using the words that you've shared, perhaps, and many times we feel that they were inadequate, or I could have done it better, or, bottom line is, we're right. But God can take even our stumbling efforts and use them to give water to a thirsty soul, to say, that's what I've been looking for. And they come to the point of understanding and embracing this Jesus who loves them so much. They make a choice to turn from their idols and follow Jesus. We're not responsible for their response, but we are responsible for building a bridge. Paul said it this way in Colossians chapter 4, and pray for us too. By the way, prayer is a huge part of this. That God may open a door for our message so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ for which I am in chains. Pray that I may proclaim it clearly as I should. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, to make them thirsty so that you may know how to answer everyone. Great practical guidance in how to build bridges to help people get to Jesus. Because everyday discipleship means actively building bridges for people to come to Jesus every day. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for being the bridge to us. There was a chasm between us and your Father, between us and God, that we could not cross. And we were set to participate in that day of accountability. And there was judgment in store because you are a righteous and holy God. You are pure and perfect. And we should never forget that. Forgive us for the times where we try to bring you down to our level. You will not have that happen because you are who you are and you are perfect and pure and holy. We acknowledge that this morning. And because of that, there was that gap, that huge gap that we could not cross between you and us. And in your love and mercy and compassion, you never wanted us to remain separated from you. And so you sent Jesus to be the bridge, to be the one who would pay our debt so that we could experience life with you, that we could be forgiven, that we could know that on that day of judgment, our debt has already been paid. That's your love for us. Thank you that for many of us in this room, we have made that decision. We have embraced Jesus as our Savior, our rescuer. And Lord, now help us to live as bridge builders. Help us to listen to people well. Give us wisdom to hear their hearts, not just their words. And give us wisdom as to how to bring you into that conversation as the one who can ultimately meet their deepest needs, whether they know it or not at the time. Give us courage, knowing that as we seek to build bridges graciously and even lovingly, we won't always do it right, whatever that means. That sometimes we may experience rejection. Sometimes there may be confusion. Help us to have courage and wisdom to keep going, because it's so worth it. God, that we would stand in your presence one day and that we would hear that we had a role in helping just one person come into your family, have hope where they didn't have hope, have forgiveness where they felt guilt and shame, have life where they were spiritually separated from you. If we just knew that there was at least one person that we helped walk across that bridge, how fulfilling that would be in light of eternity. Let that motivate us daily. As everyday disciples, may we seek to build bridges to you for your honor and glory, and because it's the best possible option for people. Because you are the God of hope. We worship you even as we sing this song. Thank you for being our living hope. In Jesus' name, amen. I know that most, if not all of us, believe what we just sung, that he is our living hope. And if we do believe it, we have every reason to go out this week and every week seeking to build bridges that others may move from hopelessness to hope, that they may know Jesus. So ask him, even as you go, don't forget about what we experienced here this morning. As you go, would you ask him, say, God, would you help me to be a bridge builder? Would you give me eyes to see who it is? Help me to listen well and help me to always end up building a bridge to you, not to anyone or anything else, because only you can ultimately give us hope. May that encourage your hearts today. Have a great, great week, everybody.
When he told you you're not good enough, when he told you you're not right, when he told you you're not strong enough to put up a good fight, when he told you you're not worthy, when he told you you're not loved.